Chapter 62. The Burning. Sidney Grice sauntered around the old servant, whistling softly between his teeth. "Why do you not know Mr. Fairbank?" I asked. But he had buried himself into himself, folding his arms in a tight embrace.
"Let me assist you in formulating a reply,"
Mr. G. suggested cheerfully.
"It is, perchance, and you may remediate my suggestion should it be fallacious, because you were not there."
Fairbank said nothing, but eventually dipped his head. "Where were you?" I inquired.
"There was a fellow butler, Crofter Tamley, next door on the other side to Newhouse. Elderberry House, it was called."
Fairbank's voice rustled so softly that I had to strain my ears.
"His master had a well-stocked wine cellar, and left care of it to Tamley. If Crofter said a wine was corked, he was never questioned. I fell into the habit of going there, after Steephouse was put to bed, and sampling some rare and expensive vintages, almost every night towards the end."
"Did anybody else see you?" I tried to imagine him doing anything so deceitful.
"Never, and Tamley is dead now, about 5 years ago, I think."
"How convenient,"
Mr. G. muttered, stopping behind Fairbank's chair, though not necessarily for him. "So what happened?" I urged Fairbank on.
"We had drunk about half a bottle of good claret in his pantry when we saw a light flickering. Tamley went to look out of the window. He couldn't see much from where we were below stairs, but then he said, 'Bit late to be having a bonfire, isn't it?' And I was just getting up to see for myself when he said, 'Hello, that isn't a bonfire, it's Steephouse.' I jumped up, and he was right. 'Send for the fire brigade,' I shouted, and ran out. There was no doubt about it. The flames were coming through the roof and out of the windows in the south wing where all the wilds slept. There was a gap in the hedge I used to use. I ran through it and saw that all the front of Steephouse was ablaze. Masonry was already crashing down. The heat was so intense I couldn't get to within 30 feet. There could be no hope of getting inside. I could see the flames through the below-stairs windows, and somebody in the light well from the cellar. Hands reached out through the bars, and a face pressed between them. I could not think who it might be, for none of the servants lived below-stairs. And then I realized it was Eric Bocking. It was just like Master Eric to risk his life for others, and I can only suppose that he got lost in the smoke. My first thought was to thank God that he had reached safety. But then I remembered that the grating was padlocked, and I saw that his clothes and hair were on fire, and he was begging and screaming. There was nothing I could do. I watched him burn, and when he fell I staggered backwards, just getting away, and nearly tripped over Miss Frieda. She was lying on the lawn."
"Prone or supine?"
Mr. G. broke in.
"On her back,"
the old man said.
"Lying on her back."
It was as though, now that he was telling us the truth, he did not believe it himself.
"I could see straight away she was badly burned, and at first I thought she was dead. She was so charred. But then she made a noise, a whimper, I suppose, and I kneeled down beside her and said, 'Help is on its way, miss.' And she said, 'Daddy, Mummy,' and I realized they must be still in there with Bethany and Lisa, the maids, dead or dying. Dead, I hoped, after what I had seen."
He coughed violently. "Would you like a glass of water?" I offered, but he flopped his dappled hand weakly to decline.
"Miss Bocking was the first to arrive. She said, 'You have saved Freddy, Fairbank.' And when she came back, she said, 'I will see you rewarded for this.'"
He coughed again, dryly.
"What could I do? Deny it and admit that I had neglected my duty when I might have been able to help them, or take my reward?"
"Which was?" I asked.
"The rent of this house for life and £30 a year through a trust fund that Miss Lucy asked her father to set up."
Alfred Fairbank hugged himself miserably.
"And now I suppose I shall lose everything."
"Back from where?"
Mr. G. pounced.
"I'm sure I don't know, sir. Changing her dress, I suppose. It got covered in ash and singed."
"Oh, Alfred,"
Sidney Grice flung out his arms like a pantomime damsel in distress. "Rarely was a man less fitted to bear the name of our wise Wessex monarch.
I can only recall the name and dates of birth and death of a great many men and women who have been so unfittingly rewarded. But as far as I am concerned, Al, Alfie, Fred, Alfredo, you may keep your 30 pieces of silver."
Alfred Fairbanks struggled to his feet. He held out his hand, and Sidney Gryce viewed it in disgust.
"I should like to thank you, sir."
"When I survey the unaccountable things I want in this squalid world," he said, "your gratitude is not amongst their number. But do not become too cheerful, Alfred Morris, Job, Cyril, Henry, William Fairbank, for you may be sure that, before the moon has repeated its repertoire, your grievous sins will find you out."
Sidney Gryce spun balletically on his heel and strode back to the door where the key was already in the lock, magically, it seemed. A tabby cat lay curled in the sunshine. "Not a cloud in the sky," I commented.
"There is little hope of finding one elsewhere."
Sidney Gryce batted an acorn off the path and came to attention on the curb. And so he remained, immobile and staring straight ahead, for another 40 minutes until a hansom came by.